You're listening Pretty Late. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez, and we are in the Allstate Showcase studio. It's daytime. I'm not going to lie to people. We are pre-recording this because joining us is gubernatorial candidate J.B. Pritzker. I know you have a very busy schedule, so thank you for taking time out of your day to join us.
Patty, glad to be here.
People know who you are, and I want them to learn more about you. They know who you are because your name, your family name is on, you know, schools and on hospitals and the pavilion. And so they know that you've been here. They know that your family is a part of this city. And I think that's important. But why is your name so well known? I know that your family was involved in hotels, but I don't think people really realize how this all came to be, the Pritzker family, the Pritzker Foundation.
Well, you're kind to ask, and I'm really proud of my family. My my great grandfather emigrated to this country. You know, I use the word emigrated. He was a refugee. There was a pogrom in Ukraine many years ago, and they were killing Jews, and so my family, you know, escaped. There was an organization here in Chicago actually called Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society.
Okay.
And they gave him a ticket and he came over, ended up going to Clinton, Iowa, because he had a train ticket, you know, a boat ticket, a train ticket to Clinton, Iowa, because that's where the sponsoring family was.
Okay.
And they got there and then got off the train and found out there are no jobs in Clinton, Iowa, and said, well, where's the nearest place to find a job? And they said, well, probably Chicago. So got back on a train, came to Chicago, no money, and ended up living in the basement of the Chicago train station for the first few days they arrived.
Really?
And then a social service agency gave them a place to live and went to a public school. I was 10 years old. Went to a public school and learned English and went to a public university as well. So,
which public university? I'm just curious.
Well, it turns into the University of Illinois. But,
okay.
But at the time, not named the University of Illinois.
In Chicago.
The part here. Yeah.
Was, sure.
And so, I'm so fortunate. I mean, honestly, that's the beginning of the history of our family.
And the relationship with Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, Chicago was, you know, where my refugee relatives, you know, landed. And
I don't think people know the history of Chicago's involvement or this organization. What was the name of it again?
Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. Still around today.
Okay.
It's HIAS, H-I-A-S. And so, you know, that's how we landed here. And then my great-grandfather had three sons. During his lifetime, he went from having nothing to putting himself through school and getting help, obviously, from the state because it was a state university. But it became at first a pharmacist, mm-hmm. and then put himself through law school.
Wow.
And
really?
He did.
Wait, and then, pharmacy and law school?
Yeah, because, you know, apparently
that's a lot
it wasn't
of school.
There weren't enough jobs in pharmacy. So he decided he wanted to become a lawyer and got through law school and hung out a shingle, really, and managed to pay off his student loan because he had a student loan.
I would imagine.
And made a living and then had three sons, mm-hmm. all of whom ended up going to university and then law school, including my grandfather. But during his lifetime, he became a businessman instead of an attorney. He had been a real estate attorney and then became a businessman.
Okay.
Wanted to be on the ownership side instead of just the transaction advisory side. And so that's how he got into business. And then he had three sons, two of whom were lawyers. It's like a disease in my family. Indeed, my father, who was an attorney, mm-hmm. Had three children, and two of us are attorneys.
Okay.
Does
that include you?
It includes me.
All right. You went to law school as well.
I don't practice law, as you may know, but I keep my continuing legal education credits up and I'm past the bar. I'm an attorney. I can practice if I want to, but I don't. But I'm proud of that heritage. And that's really kind of the history of our family. And of course, during my father's lifetime, and he passed away when he was relatively young at 39, but he started a business with his older brother, was a motel. It started with a motel and built it up to a second motel and then a third motel. And he
Where
was 26.
They started a motel. He started a motel when he was 26.
Well, there was already a motel. It was in actually Los Angeles was where the very first one was.
Okay.
And my father's older brother found the motel. He was traveling and somebody had said, hey, you should check this little motel out. I think it's for sale. It was owned by a guy named Hyatt Von Den.
Really? And you know, that was going to be my question.
Hyatt
Where
House.
Did the name Hyatt come
yeah.
from? So That's they kept the
from.
Name?
And it was the first name of the fellow who owned it. And they kept the name because
they never
it was...
thought to change it to Pritzker?
Okay.
I mean,
Hyatt is a much better name than for a motel. And people already knew this motel.
Okay.
It was next to the Los Angeles airport. And this was back when there really weren't any airport motels. It was the late 50s. I say there weren't any. There were some, but they weren't known. That wasn't like Howard Johnson's wasn't putting motels next to airports. You know, Marriott and other big name, Hilton. They weren't putting their motels next to airports.
Okay.
So,
now they all are.
That's right.
Yeah.
But it was a new idea back then. And that's really what launched Hyatt. The second motel, the third motel were all like airport motels. And my father at 26, you know, was doing that. And my mother, too. And she was sort of designing the, you know, the lobbies and the rooms and, you know, making the, you know, the feel, the look and feel cool. And my father, who was, you know, pretty big personality and also pretty smart guy. He had been a crypto analyst in the Navy, and he graduated from Harvard undergraduate and went to University of Chicago Law School. And here he, you know, he was building a business. He didn't know anything about the business when he started, by the way, because he didn't know anything about motels.
Yeah, law school has very few courses.
Hospitality,
when it comes, yeah,
is
right.
not big in law school. You're right.
Man.
And so, yeah, so anyway, and he became, you know, even though he, like I said, he really only 13 years in the business. It was the fastest growing motel chain in America.
How soon after the first motel that they bought did they open another and then another?
Oh gosh, I think it was like within a year or two that you know that they found another motel, and you know that was back in the late 50s, and okay. so by the early 60s it had become, you know, 13 motels or something like that. I mean, it really had grown, and that was, you know, big successful. I mean, For us, it was a big successful thing, not obviously compared to Hilton or Sheraton or any of the big companies back then. So it wasn't until 1966 that he managed to find an opportunity to buy a hotel, and it was an accident, really. Somebody
it's
came.
A good accident.
It's a great accident because it was actually a bankrupt, empty shell of a hotel in Atlanta, and someone approached him and said, would you like to buy this and finish it, because the owners had basically gone bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Atlanta, so there, you know, weren't any really, as far as I know, there weren't any really big successful hotels in Atlanta, but this one was next to their version of a kind of a merchandise mart, let's say.
Sure.
In Atlanta, and you could buy it relatively cheaply, but the finishing it was what cost a lot. So he ended up sort of mortgaging the rest of the company in order to build this one big hotel. And it was an atrium lobby hotel.
Okay.
Back then, there really weren't any atrium lobby hotels. People thought that was a waste of space. You know, why would you have a big atrium when you just need rooms?
Right.
And so the architect, John Portman, was the one who was trying to find a buyer for this thing. He's an Atlanta architect, and he became famous later because of
the
that
atriums.
Hotel.
Wow.
And so my father, who, again, was like 33 at the time, 32 at the time, you know, he mortgaged the whole company basically to finish this hotel in Atlanta, and kind of did everything he could to make it successful, crossed his fingers when they opened the doors, and it ended up being a real success because people were so excited by the idea of like glass elevators, you know, and it looked to some people, it looked like, you know, Buck Rogers was the
yes.
kind of show back then. But so anyway, it became successful, and then the rest is kind of history. Hyatt grew
just a little bit.
Atrium lobby hotel.
I'm still trying to wrap my mind around the fact that they kept the name of the owner of the motel. Does his family ever say anything like, hey, no?
Von Den, I'm not sure where they ended up. Yeah.
How interesting. Yeah. That's an amazing story. And you've spoken before about how your mom, your dad put you to work, or your mom did, working in the rooms, changing sheets. Like, that was your first job, really.
That's right. And I know people have this maybe image of what it was like to grow up in my home. But I actually was born out in California, and grew up. The second motel was actually near the San Francisco airport. So I grew up near there. And what turned out to be Silicon Valley. But when I was born, it wasn't called Silicon Valley.
Right.
You know, the motel that was near our home was the motel that I got my first job at. It was, you know, my mother wanted me to have a hard job for a first job at age 14. She wanted me to know how to work hard, and I'm grateful for that. And so I got the job of picking up the dirty sheets from the various motel buildings. There was multiple little buildings on this one property in Palo Alto, California.
Okay.
And so the only fun thing about that job was I got to drive a golf cart for the first part of the day.
And who doesn't like that?
Yeah. When you're 14, it's a neat thing to do. The not so great part of the job was, you know, was loading the sheets up, you know, taking them to the laundry facility and putting them in the washing machine and then in the dryer. But the most memorable thing about that first job was really what my mother said to me on the first day, which I think about all the time. And that was as I was leaving the house with my bus fare in pocket and my lunch, my first summer job, you know, I was nervous, and my mother stopped me and she put her hands on my shoulders and she looked me in the eye and she said, "Now remember, you have to work twice as hard as the guy next to you because you didn't earn this job." And he did.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and I know why my mother was telling me that. I know there are a lot of people, by the way, that you know, have to work twice as hard to get a job or to keep a job. My mother was telling me that, you know, that you're really lucky, you know, that you have good parents and that you're going to be able to afford to go to college and, you know, and pursue the things that you want to pursue in your life. And so you got to work hard to earn that. And I think about that all the time because my mother passed away when I was 17 mm-hmm. and she was 49. And, you know, she really, you know, she's a single mom. And even though she had some resources because my, you know, parents had been successful at the motel and hotel business, she suffered. She was an alcoholic and she, you know, got left with three kids. She was a widow. And we were relatively young, you know, 7, 11, and 13.
Oh.
And for her, I mean, I just can't imagine the weight that was on her shoulders at the time. And honestly, you know, she's my hero because of that. I mean, just the you know, she struggled with a disease.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people,
is.
I think, don't know that it's a disease or didn't back then, certainly, that alcoholism is a disease. But now imagine you have all these other pressures of raising young kids and you know, you've lost your life partner. And so she just fought through all that, you know, as hard as it was. And when she was sober and, you know, and that was a reasonable amount of time. But when she was sober, she was brilliant. I mean, truly a great mom and brilliant person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the other times, obviously much more difficult on her and difficult for us. But I so admire, you know, the fighters, you know, people who, you know, she wanted to be fighting for us. She wanted to be a great mom. And I remember one day she sat down with us and gave us each a book about alcoholism.
Really?
And it was a little, you know, maybe a, I bet it was a 75-page book, something like that.
Okay.
And she looked us in the eyes and she said, you know, I want you to know that alcoholism is a disease, and you know, the things that I do as an alcoholic, I don't, you know, I don't want to do those. And I, you know, I want you to know I love you. And when I'm, you know, when I'm suffering from the disease, you know, I'm trying hard to overcome it. And I just thought, God, how hard. And now that I'm an adult,
to be so honest and to be so aware.
Look at your kids,
yeah,
you know, and say those. I mean, think about how hard that had to be for her. To be, you know, because you want your kids to view you as invincible, or you want your kids to, you know, to think of you as somebody who can take care of them. And, you know, and here she had to admit that she maybe couldn't.
Right.
Sometimes.
And she wanted to protect your innocence. And at the same time, she had to ask you to grow up a little more quickly. And especially losing your father, you were already kind of on that way. And it is. It's so hard for people. How much has it impacted your, you know, growth when it comes to seeing other people, seeing what other people go through, kind of from this perspective that none of us, I mean, the percentage of people who will ever be at your, you know, level, really, we're never going to make it to the sort of wealth, right? But, you know, you seem to have an understanding of where people are coming from through your mom's experiences, through your own experiences as a child losing your parents. How does that impact your perspective on what people go through?
Well, I certainly can't know everything that people go through, but I think going through the experiences that I had as a kid, you know, first you develop some empathy for, you know, for especially for people who, they're challenged for reasons that have nothing to do with, you know, with themselves. I mean, whether it's a disease or the circumstances in which they're born. So I think, you know, just as a kid, you develop a pretty strong sense of empathy for their situation, for my mother's situation. And I think, you know, the other part is it makes you want to fight for them. Like, I really wanted, you know, obviously I really, really wanted my mother to survive, and I wanted her to overcome her challenges. And my brother and sister and I fought hard to help her do that, you know, and she was, you know, she was challenged. And so I think that those things, you know, stay with you. I mean, especially in the years, think about the adolescent years, you know, when how impressionable, you know, we all are during that period of time. And so it imprints pretty strongly on you. But again, I'm really proud of both my parents. I mean, they were really, even at young ages, I mean, we got from them a strong sense of values, a strong sense that, you know, we have obligations in the world, and that just as importantly, social and economic justice. My mother, when she was sober, I mean, she really was a social and economic justice advocate. She not only was taking us to sort of, you know, food pantries and getting involved there, but also domestic violence shelters, you know, to help rebuild them, or to, you know, be engaged with helping to, you know, make people's lives better as kids, as young kids. And then, as you can imagine, it also involved politics. My mother was taking me around knocking on doors when I was 11 years old for progressive Democrats who were running for public office. And that imprinted pretty hard on me, too.
And what kind of responses when a young J.B. Pritzker is going door to door talking about politics? What did you get from the door when that door opened? There had to be a wide range of reactions, like get off my porch, or all right, I'll sign whatever it is. I'm not buying any.
Yeah, I've done it a lot over the years. Sure. In fact, almost every election cycle I'm out there knocking on doors, and maybe it's because I started doing it with my mom and it's a way to, you know, maybe connect with her. But I've over the years, you know, had lots of experiences with people at the doors. I think at 11 years old, you know, people are sympathetic a little bit. I mean, they're not sure.
Nice.
They're not sure. You know, you're young enough, so they're not feeling threatened.
Okay.
And that's so good. You know, you get a better reaction at 11, let's say, than adults do at the door.
I would imagine. Right. Yeah.
So that was great. And the other thing is, my mom was somebody who really tried to convince people. You know, she wasn't like, well, here's a piece of, you know, literature and right, hope you vote for this person. I mean, she would try to turn people around at the door. And there was that. And then she was a LGBTQ rights advocate. Now, remember, this is the mid 70s.
Sure.
It's the San Francisco Bay Area.
OK.
And so this is where this is the epicenter of the LGBTQ movement. I mean, then it was just the gay rights movement, but mm-hmm. So I was, you know, I was in the middle of that. I mean, I couldn't imagine, by the way, that there was anywhere in the world that wasn't like this, you know.
That's kind of wonderful.
It was. I mean, I didn't, you know, you grow up and you're like, I went to school outside of that area. And so I discovered, well, there are people who don't believe the same things. I've really spent a lot of my life, fighting for the values that my mother in particular carried with her. And it's part of our religion, too. I mean, social and economic justice, something we learned about, you know, every weekend and Sunday school or in synagogue for high holy days. So it's really part of my life, even as an adult, just standing up every day and thinking, you know, I got to stand up and fight for people's rights, and I got to stand up and, you know, make sure that that economic justice is the goal and that we're achieving it every single day. Obviously, you could spend a lifetime doing that and not fully achieve it, but I'm going to work hard.
You know, when you talk about your mom trying to win people over or see the other side, that does that inform as well, you know, the idea, because should you become governor, how do you bring people from such wildly different perspectives, right? It's one thing to go door to door. It's one thing to fight for, to say those things, to fight for social justice and economic equality. But, you know, when it comes to the state of Illinois, I've sat in the press box and watched our legislature kind of, you know, hammer out things. I'm not as familiar with how the governor's involved, because it doesn't seem as though he is necessarily participating in the process in a way that I think would be helpful. How do you bring people from such wildly different perspectives, you know, whether it's the legislature or the people of Illinois, because we're urban, we're suburban, we're rural, we're small towns, we're big towns, we're mid-sized towns. How do you bring people together to sort of, you know, not necessarily get them to agree with you, but to, you know, build a coalition, you know, of Illinoisans?
Well, I think, you know, first you got to stand on your principles and your values. So you start with that as a core. But then I think listening is a big important thing that a lot of people who get elected to office end up not doing. And I have tried to do a lot of that during my life. Just, you know, the things that I've tried to accomplish and the things that I think I have accomplished during my life have been as a result of getting people together who have different views, but with a common understanding. This is our goal, setting the goal and providing some leadership and vision about that goal. And then everybody helping to solve the problem and pull on the oar together once we've figured out how to solve the problem. Sometimes that means making adjustments to the way that I might do it if I were, you know, doing it all by myself. But you often can't get these things done by yourself, the big things. You know, getting, you know, as you know, I founded 1871, and that was something that, you know, I could never have done that by myself. You know, I had the plan for it, but I also needed help, and I wanted to make sure that everybody was going to buy in and make sure that they were on board, the entrepreneurs and community leaders and the elected leaders and everybody. And so you got to bring everybody together to do that. Same thing with the school breakfast program that I helped to expand across the state. And there are 230,000 kids now that get school breakfast, more than before. So and the Illinois Holocaust Museum, which I led the creation of. You know, again, there's a lot of opinions. There's a lot of people who, you know, want a say in it and who you need on board. And so you set a vision. You know, you try to identify what's the goal. And sometimes the goal can be almost improbable, like hard goal to reach.
Sure.
But if you set that and then say to everybody, you know what, we can do it. Now, everybody, how would you do it? How can we do it together? Here are some ideas, but what do you think? And then you bring people together to get it done. We don't have enough of that in Springfield, that's for sure. You know, across the board, elected leaders tend not to be listening to each other. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Governor Rauner is sort of chief among them. He seems to have shown up under, you know, the guise of one sort of character that he portrayed during the 2014 election. And then he all of a sudden, you know, pulled out this hidden agenda that nobody knew about, and then folded his arms and said, unless you give me these things, I'm not going to give you a budget. And so that's why we lived for 736 days without one.
And what he has gotten through, I think, more loudly than anything else, is that it's Madigan's fault. Speaker Madigan has been in office since 1971, and, you know, the problems that we have in Illinois are decades old. You know, it even predates what was going on in the 70s, you know, the way we have funded our pensions. And I thought you did a great job at the Filament Theater talking about what risks we took and the way we structured the payment. And that's getting into the weeds for everybody as far as, like, the balloon payments and things like that. But it seems to me to be a difficult needle to thread when it comes to the Democratic Party in the state of Illinois, because every Democrat is seen as being part of the Madigan machine. And some people, you know, have built up Madigan to be this, you know, this evil, you know, man behind the curtain. And other people see him as being the fighter for the working class. Somewhere in the middle is the truth between mythology and the people. I mean, his community clearly in Beverly, the south side of Chicago, support him and continue to support him. This is the way democracy works. People vote. They elect somebody. And the rest of the state has voted their legislature in, who continue to vote him as the leader. How do you figure, like, sort of navigate those waters of, well, you're a Democrat, so you're a Madigan Democrat, so, you know, you're part of the evil side of things, right? I mean, that's really
that's Democrats messaging who, for sure, that the Republicans have been, you know, spending a lot of money. I mean, I think they spent $30 or $40 million, you know, doing that over the last 2 years under Bruce Rauner. And look, I'm the first one to say that both parties, at one time or another, have failed the people of Illinois. And they've worked together sometimes in failing the, you know, the people of Illinois. I'm the pension problem that you were mentioning began with a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature.
Mm-hmm.
I think the difference is, so, you know, we can point to, you know, the fact that Illinois is 50th among the 50 states in state funding for education. That didn't start 2 years ago.
No.
That started many years before that. So we have a lot of challenges, but it wasn't just Democrats. It was Republicans. Remember, we've had more years over the last 40 or so of Republican governors than we had Democratic governors. So, you know, everybody deserves a little bit of, you know, a blame here, I guess. But here we are. We came into 2015, you know, with big challenges, and people kind of pinned their hopes on Bruce Rauner, maybe, you know, shaking up Springfield.
A lot of Democrats I know voted for Rauner because they wanted to shake things up.
Yeah.
They felt that we were going in the wrong direction, and maybe this billionaire who is successful at business can lead us in the right direction. And I have trouble with that because having no political experience, not apparently understanding how to build a political coalition. And the other thing to me is that government's not supposed to run at a profit. It's education, safety, and the health of the citizens of Illinois. And that includes, you know, the roads and our hospitals, our first responders and our schools. How do you make a profit off of that or think that somebody who is skilled at that will be able to justify, you know, there's just been a wall of no when it comes to helping the people of Illinois is what it seems like to many people.
And so here, you know, when Bruce Rauner showed up, people had some hope. But nobody expected that. They didn't elect him on this right-wing agenda, this Koch brothers agenda that he shows up with, and now he's gone double down on. You know, people elected him thinking that maybe he'll work with people in Springfield and try to lead them, and yet he has not. He just doesn't want to meet. He doesn't want to solve the problems. You know, he knows that sometimes you've got to compromise if you're a Republican governor in a fundamentally Democratic state, and yet he is unwilling to do that. And so, you know, if you go without a budget in the state, you know, the safety net falls apart and our schools, you know, are left behind. And he really drove us off a cliff as a result of his intransigence, as a result of his unwillingness to sit down and figure out how to solve the problems. I really believe that sitting down, and you have to have a set of principles, you know, and mine, you know, include, for example, a progressive income tax, not a flat income tax for the state. Mine include raising wages by raising the minimum wage in the state. You know, mine include standing up for our youngest kids. And I've done that for 20 or more years in early childhood education, making sure that kids get quality child care, quality preschool. I think standing up for a set of principles is very important. But I also think you've got to listen. And he doesn't do any of that. And so here we went for so long without a budget. And remember that the you know, every day as governor, you shouldn't be waking up thinking about how to lower people's wages or how to lower workplace safety. You need to be thinking about how to raise people's wages. What do you know? And increase workplace safety and stand up for the people of Illinois. And I think because as a businessman, he had never had any government experience. I think he didn't know the difference. I think he thinks that government is about a spreadsheet. And not
that's
about
what it
people.
Seems like.
And I spent, you know, I spent several years on Capitol Hill working, including for the senior senator from Illinois. I ran the Illinois Human Rights Commission, which is a state agency.
What led you to want to hold that office?
Well, I think I mentioned my mom and, you know, fighting for people's individual rights and their civil rights. And so that, you know, the opportunity to run the state's civil rights court was exciting to me.
I don't think people realize it because they think, oh, well, where's this, you know, this billionaire going to come in and run the state? You sound as though you've been involved in state policy, state politics, and the rights of Illinoisans for quite some time. And when were you the head of the Illinois Human Rights
Association? In the early 2000s. And when I got there, by the way, the Republicans had been running it in the years before. And when they turned it over, you know, the Tribune had editorialized that this was one of the worst run agencies, essentially, in state government, and that maybe it should be done away with. You know, this is the state civil rights court.
Right.
And so the Republicans had kind of run it into the ground. And people were waiting years to get justice. You get fired from a job, just to be clear what it does. If you got fired from a job because you're black or because you're gay or because you're a woman who's been sexually harassed and you get fired, those are all protected classes, and you need to seek justice, but you can't afford an attorney, you can go to the Department of Human Rights and then get your case heard by the Illinois Human Rights Commission.
Okay.
And that's the civil rights court that I ran. And so, you know, we had judges who were making decisions about people's cases. When I got there, sometimes you had to wait 4 years before I got there to get justice. Imagine you got fired from your job and 4 years later you get justice. So
wow.
I worked with the Republicans and Democrats. It's a bipartisan commission. And I worked with the Republicans and the Democrats to figure out how to solve the problem of the backlog. And we worked hard and we put in, you know, key performance indicators, and we got the staff together and said, look, everybody, we've got to drive toward this result. Let's make sure that we're getting people the justice that they deserve. And I think people began to understand the importance in the agency, the importance of standing up for that. This may be a small agency, but it's a critical agency for the people who seek justice.
Absolutely.
And so we succeeded. And I was very proud of the work that I did there.
And you also get to learn about what, you know, what the employer side is, what the employee side, what the individual experience is like. And as somebody who, you know, a lot of people see as, you know, running these big businesses and as a billionaire, you know, what does he know about the everyday experiences? It sounds to me as though you have found ways to make sure that you're involved, that you have the ability to hear what people's stories are. How do you continue to do that in other ways since your position as the head of the Illinois Human Rights Commission?
Well, you know, like I mentioned earlier, for more than 20 years, I've been engaged in early childhood education. That's mostly been for at-risk and mm-hmm. black and brown communities, low-income communities, and really all across the United States. It's true that thousands of kids have gotten preschool and child care in Illinois because of the work that I've done. But it's also true that I've fought to make this, you know, an issue across the United States, worked in other states to make sure that governments are focused on this too. But here in Illinois, we have a great opportunity going forward to become the leader in this, in my opinion. We have all the resources. We have the Erickson Institute, you know, which is one of the great educational institutions for early childhood education.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara Bowman, who founded it, who's just one of the, you know, leaders in the field. Irving Harris had been a philanthropist here in Chicago, and he really seeded all these organizations around Illinois. So we have great resources, but then the government is falling down on the job. The government of the state of Illinois falls down on the job. You know, when Bruce Rauner cut child care assistance in this state by 90%, 90%. So, you know, people who were making $40,000 a year were able to get some child care assistance, and $30,000 and $20,000 a year were able to get before he came into office.
Right.
He tried to cut it down to only $8,000. So if you made $10,000 a year, you wouldn't get any child care assistance, or if you made $15,000 or $20,000. And that's just wrong. And so I just think we have to reverse what Bruce Rauner's done. We have to reverse the thinking about it, which is we got to stand up for working families, and we got to make sure that we're, you know, people are striving to get to the middle class, get a hand up, and then, you know, fixing the safety net, standing up for our middle class, fixing the safety net, and people want to get to the middle class.
I had to text your press secretary because I know that you have a schedule. So let me ask just one more question. I have so many more. My son had questions for you too, so I hope that you can come back and join us again because I have a lot more to get to. But I think the biggest thing right now today, not just this day, but in the, you know, for 20 to 30 years, and actually since President Nixon decided to change the way insurance companies were able to make a profit and the way healthcare is run, obviously this week what we're all talking about is Medicaid, it's healthcare. You know, and this is a much bigger topic than we can wrap up on. But I guess the one question is, well, where do you stand as far as what Illinois should do when it comes to healthcare?
Well, we need universal health care across the United States. So that's my first position. Obviously, under Donald Trump and Paul Ryan and the Republicans, we're probably not going to see that in the next couple of years, although I believe we can take them all out in 2020. But short of that, we obviously need to fight hard to prevent them this week in particular from repealing the ACA. And I've been loud and proud about my opposition to that. I was just protesting yesterday at the Federal Plaza. And you may know that last year I was probably I know that I'm the, gubernatorial candidate that fought hardest to defeat Donald Trump. I was in multiple states knocking on doors and phone banking and raising money and giving money. And I went on national television and called him what he is, which is a racist and a xenophobe. But even after he won, after I got out of the fetal position the day after the election, I was, fighting. And that's something that I'll continue to do, and I'll do it as governor. Now, to the healthcare issue in the state, Bruce Rauner has been utterly silent on all this. And remember that if they repeal the ACA, we are going to be left with an enormous bill because we still have to provide health care, that people end up in emergency rooms. People need preventative care. They need basic care just to it'll cost us all less if we actually have a larger pool of people who are in the health care system. So the more we throw people out, the more we make it more expensive for the people who are in. So, Bruce Rauner said zero about this. It wasn't until Trump Care seemed to have failed the other day that he finally, after all those months of discussion about it, he finally came out and said, well, oh, yeah, I would have opposed Trump Care, too. And now he's silent on the repeal of the ACA. And where is he? I mean, this is leading from behind. When you're unwilling to say anything until after it's a fait accompli.
Right.
So I want to stand up for people's health care. I want to make sure that that Medicaid should be extended, make sure that everybody in the state gets covered. That's what we need to work toward. And we can do that if we have a progressive income tax and a real focus on making sure that we all care for one another in this state. We are one community in Illinois. He wants to make it a war between Chicago and downstate.
Oh,
he wants to make it a war, a class warfare between people who have and people who have not. But the reality is we are one community, and that safety net is there for everybody, because we all discovered, didn't we, in 08-09, that there were people, we all know people who had a job and they had a mortgage, and something happened in 08-09 that threw you out of your job, and all of a sudden your mortgage is at risk, and your home is at risk, and your whole lifestyle, maybe your whole family, is at risk. And that's why the safety net is there. That's why we have to rebuild it. That's why we can't ignore it and do what Bruce Rauner's done to it, break it apart, mental health facilities, shelters, all the services that people who are striving to get to the middle class need. We need to uphold. That's our obligation as a state, if you ask me.
Well, I don't want to make your press secretary nervous. I know she told me you had a tight schedule, and I know you've got a lot going on. We've been talking to J.B. Pritzker, gubernatorial candidate, and there were things that you brought up just in that last answer that I wanted to ask more questions about. So we really would love to have you back when your schedule allows.
Anytime, Patty. Thanks.
And it really is. It was great to meet you. We will feature as many of the candidates as possible. I've told you off the air. Actually, I've told my listeners on the air what I think of some of the other candidates. I wish you the best. I want the best for Illinois, and it sounds as though you do too. I know that Senator Biss also fights for people. People think of this race as kind of like, oh, more billionaires. And I think it's important to keep telling, each candidate's story to learn where they're coming from, so it's not these big, grand sort of titles. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Patty.
Appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon. You're listening Pretty Late. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez. More after this on 720 WGN.